after spending two chapters on talking about the gunas, sattva, which is pure knowledge, rajas, which is passion, activity, and tamas, which is laziness, indolence, don't care, 14th chapter and then the 22 verses of the 17th chapter, Bhagwan suddenly in the 23rd verse comes up with a very new idea towards the end of the chapter. Om Tat Sat Iti Nirdesha Brahmanas Trividas Spritaha. And Barbara also asked last time, it doesn't seem to be connected. Why is this suddenly these four verses, which are absolutely separate from the entire meaning or the entire theme of the chapter? And I myself was thinking about it. One is, as we had talked last time, when you're doing these activities, yajna, dan, or tapa, yajna means the rituals or the community activities. Tapa is the penance and self-control, and dana is charity. When there is any imperfection or any deficit or any fault, then by chanting the Lord's name, Om Tat Sat, you purify, and that even that fault is removed. Another reason I thought of, I don't know, maybe you agree or disagree, but what a lot of people think, that the goal of life is to do good, and that alone is enough. You know, you, as you say, I have a friend who is a physician. He says, look, I do a good job. I take good care of my patients. I'm honest. I'm sincere. I take care of my family, my parents. Why do I need to come to these lectures? I'm living a good life. I'm a good person. And that's very good. We are not saying that that is wrong. And if you live a good life, honest, that's very good. But that's not the end of life. There is something higher. If you are only living at the worldly level, it's just very nice. But what will happen is you will continue to be there. It's like you keep doing high school again and again. You say, why do I need to go to college? I can keep doing 12th grade. I'll get 2400 in my SAT. Why? No, you need to go higher. You need to grow further. And so this few verses that Bhagwan has put at the end are the PhD level. They are meant for us to evolve, to go beyond karmas. Karmas are very good, but then beyond karma is gyan, it is knowledge. And to know who I am, to know who is God and what is my relationship, these verses take us to the next level of sadhana. Otherwise, you will again take birth in the same yoni and again, you know, punarapi jananam. So if I want to evolve, if I want to go higher, I need to learn this knowledge. And this is the knowledge, the essence of the Upanishads. Om Tat Sat is the highest knowledge. Now people ask, how do we go from worldly to the next step? And we always wonder, you know, because we that is very easy. You know, you do good job, you're honest, you're sincere, you serve the community, help others. That's very wonderful. But then there seems to be a jump, a leap of faith. And the way they describe it is there are three stages. There is the stage of deep sleep, dream, waking. And then above waking is the state of Turiya. That's the state where all these Mahatmas live in, all these realized souls, Shankaracharya and Guru Dev Swami Chinmayananda and Jesus and Buddha and all these Mahatmas lived at that level. How do we go there? What is the quantum leap? So actually, I recently came across a commentary by Swami Chinmayananda on Atma Bodh. We are actually doing that in our Wednesday class. And just casually, Gurudev mentioned 6-7 points. And I said, this is the essence of sadhana. This is what we have to do. So I wrote down those 7 points. He just in one paragraph, you know, just mentions it. But such profound knowledge. I was amazed by, you know, how these great souls, very easily it just comes to them. He wasn't even talking about the main theme of the chapter. He said to purify, to develop the sharp faculty of perception. And I thought if these 7 points we all apply, you are already, that's like the ladder that will take you to the next step. And I think this is something I myself feel we should take a picture, put on our phone and see how many of these I fit in, and if I don't have them, let me do them. So that's why I put those 7 points on top, that how do I develop my faculty of perception to clearly see where I have to go in the next step. So, you know, in order I have put whatever I thought. One is to purify the mind. What do we mean by a pure mind? Pure mind means which does not have negative qualities like anger, greed, jealousy, hatred. So consciously develop positive qualities. Second is penance. When we hear the word penance, we think of standing on one leg in the Himalayas. We don't mean that. What you mean is develop a life of self-control. Live a life of moderation. Not too much, like Krishna in the sixth chapter says. Yoga is not for those who eat too much or don't eat at all. Some people think, you know, just starving all the time, fasting. Some people think, he says, yoga is not for people who sleep too much or don't sleep at all. You know, some people think 3 hours, 4 hours sleep, I have to get up at 3:30 to meditate. Yoga is not for those people who work too much or don't work at all. You know, so you live a life of moderation, live a life of self-control, don't overindulge. And the third is develop devotion and love for God. That is very, very important. What happens to us when we get on the path of knowledge, we think, all right, this bhakti is for these ignorant people. You know, we are educated. This is 21st century to sit and sing bhajans, boring ka. No, that is equally important. Maybe you don't sing bhajans, maybe whatever way, but having a love and a personal relationship with God is very important. Thinking about him with love and developing a closeness, not a fear, but love for God is very important. Then the fourth is knowledge, reading the scriptures and getting the right judgment. Also, reading the scriptures by themselves is not that easy, but having a teacher. That's why, you know, we have all these Swamijis who come, Swami Ishwarananda and Vimalji and all. So sitting with them, listening to them and developing right judgment and see how they handle the subject. A lot of the Gita, whatever little I know, is from listening to these Swamijis, how Swami Ishwarananda ji gets his own ideas of the Bhagavad Gita. It is amazing. So that's how we develop right judgment. And then the number five is discriminate between real and unreal, between temporary and permanent. Because we are, at this moment, are focused on the unreal. By unreal, we're not meaning that what is not existing, but which is temporary. This table, this chair, this house, this car, this money, this wealth, this jewelry, clothes, all that is temporary. Our relationships, I love somebody, my job, my prestige, everything is temporary. So we focus on that and we spend our whole life chasing after temporary. So find what is real. See, in this chart, you know, again, I have this body, mind and intellect. With the body, I perceive objects. With the mind, I feel emotions. With the intellect, I think the thoughts. So with the body, mind and intellect, I'm chasing the world of objects, emotions and thoughts, love and God. So for, instead of that, focus on Om, which is the permanent, which is Lord, which is the goal of life. And when that happens, when you do all those things, then your eye of wisdom gets uncovered. They say, open your eye of wisdom, you know, man ki aankhe khol. But Swami Chinmayananda says the eye of wisdom is always open. Our problem is we have covered it. The eye of wisdom is the Lord within us. We have covered it with our vasanas, our tendencies, our selfishness. So as you reduce your vasanas through the first five steps, the eye of wisdom will become manifest. And then this person will have the true knowledge. And then he will not superimpose objects on the infinite self. Then he will see everything as Brahman, everything as Lord, everything as... That's what all these great saints did. You know, they saw everything as God. Everything is me. So this is the stepwise sadhana that we can all practice. To go from the temporary to the permanent, to go from sattva, rajas and tamas, it is good. You know, if you can go from tamas to rajas and rajas to sattva, it is very good. But do not stop there. Go beyond sattva to the highest. I hope this answers your question, because I was myself thinking about it. Why did the Lord suddenly put these four verses? which do not seem to be connected. I think because he wanted us to wake up. See, it was very interesting the way the Gita was written. It is said that Ved Vyas ji wanted to compose, you know, the Mahabharata, which is 100,000 verses. And in the 100,000 verses, he was going to speak very fast, so he needed somebody to write. And so Ganesh ji was asked, so he was going to write, you know, the entire 100. That's the biggest epic in the world, 100,000 verses. And Ganesh ji said, but look, if you stop speaking, then I'm going to disappear. You have to continuously talk. So now Ved Vyas ji has to compose 100,000 verses without stopping, and it has to be logical, it has to be a story, it has to have philosophy. It's not easy, you know, only a realized, it is said he was Vishnu's avatar. So he could do it, but for most of us, it'll be very difficult. So he thought, even for me, 100,000 verses will be hard. So he tells Ganesh ji, okay, if I stop speaking, you can stop writing, that is fine. But I have one condition. You will not write unless you understand what I'm writing. So Ganesh ji said, okay. So purposely, Ved Vyas ji used to put verses like these where Ganesh ji has to think, you know, what is he saying? So then he thinking, so then he has time to compose. That's the story. It's a funny story. But the idea is that, you know, for us also to keep us awake. See, because otherwise what happens is when you're listening to the teacher, you have a tendency to fall asleep. And in the olden days, the scriptures were not written. They were spoken. And the students would, you know, doze off, as happens in, you know, my class too. Sometimes people do sleep. I try to keep them awake with jokes and stories, but doesn't always work. So this teacher would put things like these so that the students would wake up. Huh? What did he say? So that's the reason these verses were composed. So last week, Sri Krishna told us that Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat is the name of Lord, is the name of Bhagwan. And there are three. Why do we use three words? Om, I'll just summarize for those, last time the class was smaller. Om is the transcendental reality, what we call as Brahman. Brahman is the substratum, the support of the whole universe. Brahman is something you cannot see, hear, smell, taste, touch. You cannot even think about him. You cannot even contemplate. You cannot even understand. It cannot be taught. They say, what? All that? Yes. That is something which only in your silence, when your mind is silenced, you can experience it as me. Because Brahman is the whole universe, but it is hidden from us. So it is called transcendental. It cannot be seen, heard, cannot even be taught, explained, all that. So Om represents that Brahman. But now that Brahman is very hard for me to relate to. I say relate to the formless. So how can I relate to the formless? It has no form, no shape, no color. Just don't worry. If I say relate to Krishna, that I can. Arre, wo pehle kyon nahi bola? You know, Murli, while he's standing and playing, or relate to Jesus, or relate to Buddha or Guru Nanak. It is easier for us, you know, relate to Shiva. Okay, Shiva sitting in meditation. So that same Om, that Brahman, then takes the form of all these celestial powers, whether it's Krishna or Ram or Jesus or Buddha or Shankaracharya, all these realized masters. So that is Tat. So that is Bhagwan, not the human beings, but God himself taking the form of Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, the creator, sustainer, destroyer, what we call as Ishvara. So that is Tat. And then Sat, the third one, the third name is existence. We all exist. This table exists, this pointer exists, she exists, I exist, the chair, glass. Everything that exists, that is, that you see in the world is called Sat. So Om is the transcendental, Tat is the Ishvara, the Lord that we know, that we can relate to, and then Sat is existent. So having said this, now what Sri Krishna is doing, he's going to individually go into details of what Om means, what Tat means, and what Sat means. So each verse, Om has one verse, Tat has one verse, and then for Sat, we have two verses. So today we'll talk about Om, and then if we have time, we'll talk about Tat. So verse number 24. तस्मादो मित्युदाहृत्य यज्ञदानतपक्रियाः प्रवर्तन्ते विधानोक्ताः सततं ब्रह्मवादिनाम्। So what is Om? That is explained here, and Om actually is a lot of material on it. If I finish it today, I may not be able to do the next verse. Tasmat, therefore, Sri Krishna says, Om iti udahritya. Om, this chanted, udahritya means chanting. What happens? Yajna dana tapa kriyaha. So remember, we had said that Krishna had said there are three things. Yajna is the rituals. Also, yajna is any community activity where the community gets together to build a church or a temple or this mission. That is called yajna, where people get together and work. And dana is charity, and tapa is self-control, living a penance, the living a life of self-control. So when you do these three activities, chanting Om Pravartante. So people who are Satatam Brahmavadinam. So Brahmavadinam is the last word. So Brahmavadinam, people who are seekers of Brahman, people who want to evolve, people who want to go higher, Satatam Pravartante. They always begin by chanting Om. So before chanting starting any activity, they chant Om. And where is this written? In the Vidhan Uktaha. It is written in the scriptures. In the scriptures. And if we look at it actually every day, that's what we do. At least we should do before you start your day in the morning. If you have a prayer room, you bow down to the Lord and say, okay, I'm on my way today. May my day go well. Before you get out of bed, at least I try every morning, before I get out of bed, just lying in the bed, just chant a few times. Om Namah Shivaya or Om Shri Krishna Shan. Whatever the Lord's name is, chant at least 5 or 10 times before you get out of bed. And then before eating, a lot of us do that. Before eating, we say grace or we, invoke the Lord's grace, thanking. Before you start a new factory or start a house construction, or before you move into a new house, you do Graha Pravesh. You do a housewarming. Of course, a lot of times nowadays people do housewarming with alcohol. But ideally, it should be done by calling a pandit and have them do a proper puja in your house so that you inaugurate your house in the right way. So that's what Krishna says, that any activity that is you begin should be done by chanting Om. Now, in the past, they used to use Om because it was the pre-Puranic times. In the Vedic times, Om, Tat, Sat, these were the names of God. But nowadays, in the Puranic times and afterwards, we don't relate to Om, but we say Shri Krishna or Shri Ram or Jesus or Shiva. So those we related. So they say, okay, then you can start by chanting that. You can say Om Namah Shivaya or the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, or Shri Krishna Sharna Mama, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Most of the mantras start with Om. Like we say, Om Sahanavavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Om Purnamada, Purnamidam. So Om is the basic beginning of all mantras. And Om represents the name of God. So if you want to start some activity, you start by chanting the name of God. But it is very important not to do it mechanically. See, what is happening now is that everything has become so mechanical. In Gujarat, you go, Jai Shri Krishna, Jai Shri. They just mechanically say, do they think of Krishna at that time? Or in North India, Ram Ram, Ram Ram. When they meet everybody in the morning, Ram Ram. You are saying Ram Ram, but are you thinking of Ram? When you say that. So when you are chanting the name of the Lord, or when you are greeting somebody as Ram Ram or Jai Shri Krishna, you should think that Krishna is in this individual. That's why I'm calling him that. Or whoever I see is Ram in front of me. And so with that attitude, that's why when we also say Hari Om. Hari Om is the same thing, that I see Hari in you and Om, but it has become so mechanical. Hari Om, you know, we just walk around saying that. So it should not be mechanical. Chanting the name of the Lord should be done consciously. Think about the form of the Lord. When I'm saying Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, I should think of Krishna. When I say Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, I should visualize the form of Jesus. So that is how Om should be chanted. Now, we'll talk a little bit about what Om means. So we already decided it should be chanted. It should be every activity should start by remembering the name of the Lord. One should make a habit of that. Now, Om, A-U-M, in the Mandukya Upanishad, yeah, there it is. They said A represents the waking, U represents the dream, and M represents the deep sleep. So Om, A-U-M, so it represents the waking, dream, and deep sleep, which represents the entire world of experience for us. When I'm awake, I'm seeing the world. I'm seeing the plants, trees, and birds, and animals, and humans, and buildings. So the waking world, which is the five elements and the total universe, is the waking world, and that is A. That is then in my dream, I don't see the waking world. I don't see this world created by God, but I create my own world in my dream. And the world, how do I create? I take experiences from different times. You know, what I have seen yesterday, last week, last month, some very powerful thought is in my mind. And we put it all together and we create this story in our dream, which may or may not make much sense. So that is my own dream world. And each one of us occupies a different dream world. And then the third is the world of deep sleep. In deep sleep, I don't experience anything. So I experience the waking world, the dream world, and the world of deep sleep, where I say I experienced nothing. And I wake up in the morning and say, ah, I had a very sound sleep. Oh, I had a dreamless sleep. You know, that's very good. Or my sleep was disturbed. I was stressed out. So the deep sleep is the three states. And then the fourth state is called Turiya, or the state of silence. And when we chant Om, we say it should be chanted carefully with attention, and then there should be a silence. Not Om, 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 Om. No, not like that. Om. And then give a silent pause, and then again go. And the silence is more important than the sound, because they say that in silence, you can experience the reality. The sound, whether it's Om or whether it's Sri Krishna or it is the scriptures or it is Vedas, those are all very good. They are the pointers. But ultimately, they all lead you to that silence, that inner silence. When the mind becomes still, when the mind is no longer running. So chanting or, you know, doing all these mantras, doing meditation, puja, all helps to quieten the mind. And then in that quiet mind, when your mind is still, in the silence, the Lord talks to you. That's why they say in prayer, I talk to God. In meditation, God talks to me. Because in meditation, when my mind is completely still, then I experience that inner peace, that inner silence. So that state is called Turiya, or the state of silence. So what they are saying, that Om is the one that connects all the three states, the waking, dream, and deep sleep. How do you say that? Because I remember, right? I remember my waking experiences. Then I, you know, remember my dream. At least some of the dreams you remember that are very strong. And then I also remember that I don't remember anything in my sleep. I didn't experience anything. So there is one who has to experience all, right? That's how only I can connect. Like what I did at age 5, what I did at age 15, what I did at age 25. How do I remember? Because I was there. That one I, that constant, is the Om. The consciousness was always there. My body changed, my mind changed, my intellect changed, my vasanas changed, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker changed, the objects, emotions, and thoughts changed. But I, that experiencer, the Om, the permanent, is the one who is always there. And I was there now. I was there when I was 5 years old. I remember my experiences. And then even when afterwards, when this body no longer exists and I go and take another life, the Om will be there. So Om is the one that connects all the three states. So that is the meaning of Om. And as we said, all mantras and activities start with chanting of Om. And then I already mentioned the Puranic gods like Shiva and Krishna and Ram and all that. And Brahmaji, as we had talked last week, started creation with chanting of Om. He said Om and Atha. These were the two words Brahmaji used. When he started creation, Om was the word and Atha means now. So now I am ready to start creation. And so even Brahmaji, who is the creator of the universe, chanted Om as the first one. That means Om representing the highest reality, who he says may the highest reality, because the job of creation is not easy, you know, to create this beautiful universe, not only here but all the other worlds and all the planets and this, all the dark holes and kya kya hai in the universe. So Brahmaji, before he created, he needed that. And for, you know, if you are not a Hindu, then for a Muslim, you know, they chant Allahu Akbar. You know, same thing. Allah is great. Again, that is the equivalent of Om. As Christian, you may chant name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. A Buddhist may say Om Mani Padmane Om. Again, there they say Om. So the point is that it could be whatever the mantra you are chanting represents the Lord himself. Now, the other thing about Om is that it appears in many scriptures. Om appears in many scriptures. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter, Sri Krishna says, Om itek sharam brahma vyaharan mam anusmaran yak prayati tyajan deham tato yati param gatim. So he says Om is Akshar Brahma. What do we mean by Akshar Brahma? Akshar of course means indestructible, but here Akshara means a word, one letter. Akshar, you know, they say Akshar, you know, in Hindi they say na Akshar ka kha ga gha. So Om is an Akshar, is a letter. And this letter represents Brahman. Brahman is represented by Om. This letter Om, so Om represents, and we'll talk later on about how they named the Lord. How was God given the name Om? We'll talk about that at the end. So Krishna says, this Akshar Brahma, one who chants Mam Anusmaran. So again, Krishna says, when you chant, remember me. Don't just mechanically say Om, Hari Om. When you say Hari Om, you should be visualizing the Krishna's form. So he says, one who chants this mantra Om, just Om, remembering me, ya prayati tyajan deham, one who leaves at the time of giving up the body. So at the time of death, when you give up the body, if you chant Om, then you reach the highest, tato yati param gatim. So they say the last thought that you have before you die is where you go. So if your last thought at the time of death is Om, you will reach Om. But if your last thought at the time of death is, you know, my dog, and sorry, that's where you... People are so attached to animals, more even than their children. I'm sorry, you know, people, a lot of people have pets. And, you know, if you criticize dogs in this country, you are worse than, you know. But I really believe people get so attached to their pet. Oh, my God. And they spend all their life just, you know, taking care of the pet and worrying. Or whatever. You know, your last thought could be your car or your jewelry or your wife or your children, or, you know what, we get so attached to things or money, you know, that's the biggest thing. There are so many stories about it, but I'll just tell one story. There are a lot of funny stories. So this man was on his deathbed, you know, and they were playing Bhagavad Gita, you know, because they say the last thought you hear is Bhagavad Gita, you know. So they said, at least, and this guy was so rich, he had spent his whole life collecting money. And so they said, we'll have, you know, chanting of Bhagavad Gita going on with tapes and pundits. So at least his last thought will be of the Bhagavad Gita. And then he's lying there and he says, is Chunnu here? He says, Chunnu is here. Is Munnu here? You know, his other son, Munnu, here. Is Shanti here? Yes, Shanti is here. Is my wife here? Yes, my wife here. Then why is the light on in the next room? And he died. So his last thought was not of Om. His last thought was to save money, you have to turn off the light. So the point is that whatever you think throughout your life, that's what you will be. So if you want to remember Om at the time of death, start remembering from now. If you want to remember God at the time of death, only way you will remember is if you remember him right now. Doesn't matter what form you use, doesn't matter what name you use, doesn't matter whatever, but it should be the name of God. And constantly remember that, chant it as often as you can. When you see the beautiful flowers, think of God. When you see the sunrise, when you see the beautiful moon, you know, there's going to be full moon. When you see the stars, all this, you know, smile of a child. Just these are so many things you think, you read about astronomy and all these discoveries. You know, you see scientists, or beautiful singers. You know, you see people singing or nice poetry or a nice art. See the Lord, constantly remember him. So that will be your last thought at the time of death. In the Mandukya Upanishad, I was reading. Mandukya Upanishad is actually a very advanced Upanishad. But there are 12 mantras devoted to Om. And the 12 mantras, actually one of the most beautiful mantra, and that is Om Nitya Yuktasya Na Bhayam Na Vidyate Kvachit. So one who constantly chants Om will never have any fear. So why do we not have any fear? We'll talk about that. But these 12 verses of Om, Gaudapada ji had actually composed hundreds of verses. He has a karika. Mandukya Upanishad has actually very few verses, but there are hundreds of verses of karika. Does anybody know who Gaudapada was? Whom was he related with? Anybody? No? Actually, Shankaracharya ji, everybody knows, right? So Shankaracharya ji's guru was Govinda Bhagavat Pada. So Shankaracharya ji's guru was Govinda, and Gaudapada was Govind Bhagavat Pada's guru. So he's Shankaracharya ji's grand guru. So guru's guru, so he was Gaudapada ji. So he wrote hundreds of verses called the Karika. So the Mandukya Upanishad is very short. It's only 20 or so verses, but then hundreds of verses of Karika or commentary have been written. So he talks about Om very much in that, you know, the waking and the dream and the deep sleep and all that. And so that is the Om that is chanted. In the Mundaka Upanishad, that's again very interesting. Om is again covered. I said Om comes in almost all the Upanishads in the Gita. So there is a very beautiful reference. It says, Pranavo dhanu sharohi atma. Brahma tat lakshyam uchyate. So in the olden days, you know, people used to shoot bow and arrow. You know, that was the means of hunting and war, and everybody was a warrior. So to teach them, they say pranavo dhanu. So the pranava is the meaning or the name of Om. So make Om your bow. Pranavo dhanu sharohi atma. Sharo means the arrow. So Om is the bow, and Atma. Atma means I. Atma does not mean the consciousness, but I, the ego, the individuality. So make Om the bow and make yourself the arrow. So Om is the bow and I am the arrow. Now, what is the purpose of bow and arrow? You pull it and then you are shooting a target. You know, say you are not trying to kill an animal, but suppose you are in an archery competition. And there is that round target, and then you want to hit the middle of the target, what they call bullseye. And if you get that, you win. So, Om is the bow, I am the arrow, and what is the target? Brahma tat lakshyam uchyate. So, make Brahman your target. So, when you shoot the arrow, so using Om, I direct myself and I hit Brahman. I become one with Brahman. And then it says in that verse very beautifully, it says, keep your mind still. Just as a bow and arrow person shooting, if his hand is shaking, the arrow is going to go here and there. So his hand has to be still, his mind has to be still, his focus has to be precise. So they say when you want to reach that state, you have to keep your mind still. You cannot be thinking about 10,000 things. You have to be thinking about him and him alone. And the last thing they say is that just as the arrow hits the target and becomes one with it, it penetrates the target. So when you hit Brahman, you become one. You disappear. The individual disappears and Brahman alone remains. So that is Mundak Upanishad. So that again talks about the importance of Om, that using Om, I can reach the highest target. And as I said, it should not be done mechanically. It should uplift your mind. Chanting Om uplifts your mind. And it represents the reality, the creator and the created. As we said, Om Tat Sat, the reality, then the creator, Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, and the created, this whole universe, everything is represented in Om. Now, how did the word Om come to represent God? This is very interesting. I got this from Swami Shantanandaji's commentary. So they said the Rishi sat down and said, we need to name God, you know, give him a name. Otherwise, you say Brahman is formless and, you know, it's very hard. I need to give a name. So the name has to fit the individual, right? Now, suppose somebody has a name, Lakshmi Prasad, and he's a beggar. You know, Lakshmi Prasad means the Lord of Wealth. And if he's a beggar begging, how did his parents give him that name? Or his name is Ram Palwan, and he, you know, he can't even lift a dumbbell. You know, the name has to fit the individual. Or you call him Padmakshi, you know. Padmakshi means lotus eyes, and they have squint eyes. So the name has to fit the individual. And of course, the parents don't know how he's going to turn out when they give the name. They're hoping that he will turn out to be somebody good. But many times the name doesn't fit. So they said, name has to fit God, you know, God.
Wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking, right. Parents are having wishful thinking. So they said, no, name has to fit God. Now God, what is God? God has to fit the name.
The person
has to fit the name. Here it's other way. Now they knew that there is this entity called God, but we now have to give him a name. So what is God? He says he's all forms. And he is formless. All forms are him, right? Everything is God, and he is also formless. He is all the names in this universe, and he is without name. You know, Brahman is no name, but all the names are him. Anil and Satish and Keri, they are all Lord's names. He has form, and he is formless. He is Sagun, and he is Nirgun. Such a complicated individual, Bhagwan or Brahman, is what kind of name can fit him? You know, it's very difficult to find a name for somebody who is everything. Everything is him and nothing is him. He's beyond all that. So then they said, they came up with Om. Why? Because A, U, Ma represents Sagun Brahma, the visible form, that which you can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, the form, the Sagun, the form. And then Nirgun, the formless, is the silence, the Turiya. So Om represents not only the Sagun, not only the form, God with attributes, but Nirgun, God without attributes. So that's why somebody who has form and has no form, has attributes, has no attributes. They say God is very kind, merciful, compassionate, loving. Yeah, but he's even beyond those. Even those cannot describe him. Even to say he's loving, compassionate, kind, that is again only talking about the Sagun. But that true Brahman, that is even beyond all descriptions, even to call him loving, compassionate, kind, sweet, all that does not fit, is not high enough. So that's why they said Om is the only word that can take us to that highest state. There is so much we can talk about Om. It's a very, very powerful mantra. Chanting Om, when it is done with attention, done with love, done with understanding, that I am invoking the Lord, not only the God who is outside, but God who is within me. That's why we have Om as representing God's presence in me. So chanting Om takes you to that highest. So it should be done. It should be done with feeling. It should be done with attention. It should be done with love. And that kind of chanting will take us to the highest. That's why Om is considered as the most powerful mantra. And it is there in all the Upanishads. It is described in the Gita, in all our scriptures, in Bhagavat, everywhere. Because Om is very significant. And every mantra that we have, all of them start with Om. So any comments, any questions about this?
But his thought and vision is different, but he did say Ravan was dying. That's the reason he went to heaven.
Plus, actually, Ravana was a Brahma, he was a Jnani. He had done a lot of penance. That's how he got all his powers. So he was very evolved, but then he got sidetracked. But that's right, he was thinking of Ram when he died, absolutely.
But in three bad lives, then seven good lives away from God.
Right. And then he was thinking, Ram is coming, Ram is coming,
always.
He's crossing the ocean. People used to tell him, now he has crossed the ocean, now he's in the... So he was constantly, yeah, that's true. Same thing about Kansa too. He was thinking that the eighth son of Devaki will kill me. So he was thinking Krishna, Krishna all the time. So even when you hate God and think you can get moksha, how much better would be when you think with love? See, when you lovingly remember him, it's so much better than loving him as an enemy. Or, I mean, knowing him as an enemy. Yes. But thank you. That's a good point. Yeah.
I wonder if anyone has done any brain studies of the brain waves.
I'm sure it would. I don't know of any study, but they have done studies on meditation.
Yeah.
People who are in meditation, they get alpha waves. The brain waves, but I'm sure chanting Om would be similar. You know, any prayerful activity done, chanting definitely, what it does is it slows down the mental activity. The mind which is racing will come down. Yes, but Om has is not just words put together. You know, it is actually, they say the whole universe vibrates to the sound of Om. Even the rivers, if you listen to the brooks, the streams, you hear Om. Even the breath as you breathe out, you know, if you do it with attention, it is Om. In space, they say you hear the sound Om. You know, recently they were talking about you can hear the black holes colliding. And in that movie, there was a movie I saw a while back where they come in contact with some extraterrestrial beings and the sound they hear is Om. So Om is the sound of the universe. It's not just random, somebody came up with.
U comes from middle part and Ma comes from the
right.
Third part of the bronchial. So
right, yeah, from the, yeah.
And then silence, so then your mind is always quiet.
Yes. Through from the throat and the chest and the, yeah, that's right, thank you. Yeah, that's a good point. Ma, so yeah, the different parts of your physiology is used.
Consciousness is passing to
the brain. Right. Right. Yeah, plants respond, whether you're playing good music or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
Not only that, even the way the food is cooked. Okay. There is a story about Swami Chinmayananda, now that you mention it, I'll talk about it, how one of the Swamijis who was with him used to travel with him, and he went with him for lunch to Birla's house. You know, Birla is one of the richest men in India. And Swamiji ate, you know, he enjoyed the food. And that evening, they went to Anath Ashram, went to an orphanage. And in Birla's house, of course, they had 15, 20 dishes, you know, with all gold plates and everything was very elaborate because Swami Chinmayananda was coming. And then in the evening, he went to Anath Ashram in a leaf he was given, just dal and roti. And he said, Gurudev was enjoying that more than he enjoyed the one in Birla's house. So afterwards he asked, he said, Gurudev, you ate this with so much relish. And that you, okay, you ate it. He says, you know why? Because when these young boys and girls were cooking, they were doing Vishnu Sahasranama. They were chanting and that came into the food. And so Gurudev could sense that the food was cooked by the chanting of the name of the Lord, as opposed to some servant cooking. I mean, not that, you know, that the food is not, but if somebody is just doing it as a job or reluctantly, you know, why do I have to cook for my husband? He keeps eating so much. you know. Or if you do it with love, that I'm cooking for the Lord who is in my house, you know, my husband or my children. And so similar, so that attitude is very important when you cook. When you cook with chanting the name of the Lord, that actually gets transferred to the food. And then also the person eating, obviously, that's why we chant, you know, Om Brahmarpanam Brahma Havihi Brahmagnav Brahmanahutam Brahmaivatena Gantavyam Brahma Karma Samadhina. Those of you who have done Bhiksha with Swamijis, they always chant that. Just as in a Yajna Shala, everything is Brahman. The Yajna Shala is Brahman, you know, when you do the Yajna, the offering is Brahman, the fire is Brahman, the one who is offering is Brahman, and the one to whom it is being offered is Brahman. So similarly, they say that the one who has cooked the food is Brahman, the food itself is Brahman, the one eating is Brahman, and the one being nourished inside is Brahman, so that everything is the Lord. So with that attitude, one should cook, and with that attitude, one should eat.
Even the money with what they purchase,
yes,
the right money, or it's
absolutely
earned, is the person
right,
the
right.
That affects.
Yeah, actually, there's another story about Swami Chinmayananda about the money. What he would do is, you know, he had these classes, Sandipani, Radhanalai for the children, for the young men and women, where he would, you know, train them for 2 or 2.5 years. And they would be taught, and that's how all the Swami Ishwarananda and Tejomayananda ji and Vimal ji and all came from there. So if there was a big donation given from somebody, like a very rich guy and all, he would not use that money to feed those children. He said that money can be used for other mission activities. Obviously, you know, the donations you need. So for other mission activities, he might do it. But to feed those children, wherever he would give a lecture, and then people would give donation, 5 rupees, 10 rupees. He said, this is the money I'm going to use to feed my children, because this is the money I have earned with my labor. And it has not come as a big check of 1 lakh rupees or whatever. So he was very particular that the children who are studying, and actually Swamiji's tell us that in the beginning time, they actually used to have problem with money. Sometimes they would only get one meal a day. Because the Chinmaya mission, now of course they're doing very well, but in the beginning he had a hard time, you know, sometimes even to feed the people, it was difficult. And so sometimes they would only get one meal a day. Can you imagine, you know, 2.5 years you are studying and some days you only get one meal, but that is the dedication of all these. That's why they are all, you know, such wonderful teachers. So they went through hard time in the beginning, financially and every way. But he said that I'll not feed them money that has been earned, like what they call black money in India. That money which I've earned with my own sweat, where 5 rupees, 10 rupees people are giving, that is the kind of money. So he was very, very evolved.
And I remember the old days,
yes,
when a Brahmin comes to do any kind of ritual at a house, you have to give them the grains and everything. They used to cook their own food.
Right.
They used to take shower before cooking those things. So, I mean, I know, I remember vaguely, but they don't.
Yeah. No, Udipi Swamiji, G.R. Swamiji, he, whenever he comes to anybody's house, I know he came to Jayashree's house a couple of times, he brings his own people who come with him, who are used to, and they will just get the grains from the store, but they will cook it themselves. And not only that, but they will cook for the whole family. So if the Swamiji is in your house for a week, you don't have to cook anything. You know, they do all the cooking, they will even clean the dishes, they'll do everything, because he'll bring 4 or 5 people with the same idea that the food should be sattvic.
But sometimes you can offer to God and eat when you have no choice.
Yes,
that's
yes.
That's how it is, God's grace, and then you know whatever you're giving me,
right.
It's given by right. God.
Yeah, that's a very good point. If suppose you don't know.
You can say to the person, like, hey, this is.
Right.
What kind of food you're feeding? I know what you're doing, but you can't.
True.
Just say like, hey, God, take it and then give.
Right.
Or bless.
Yeah, that's true. That's why they say Om Tat Sat Iti Nirdesha. So when you chant Om Tat Sat, or chant the Lord's name, or invoke to the grace, then the food gets blessed. So we don't have to go around worrying about who is cooking and how they are cooking. Chanting of the name of the Lord purifies the food. Yes. Otherwise, yeah.
You're talking about this old memories coming back. When my mom used to cook food, the first dish go to God. with
right.
water and everything.
Right.
And then you are fighting, who will get that dish.
Right.
So, I mean, we don't do the rest of the work.
No, no, my mother used to do that also. Whatever is vegetables, dal, roti she has made, she will make a plate, offer it to God.
And
either mix it or she'll divide it. You know, little piece of roti everybody will get. So that's what they used to say, call it prasad. Yeah, the first dish used to always be given to God. Yes.
I'm just curious, when you say om, the waking dream and deep sleep, so what happens to a person who is in coma?
I think coma is equal to deep sleep. It's a prolonged deep sleep, yeah, where
so
there is no thought at all. No, he's in ignorance. He's not one with Brahman. You can only become one with Brahman in the waking state. You know, people say, in my dream, I want to realize God. You cannot. See, in deep sleep, they say that you are in contact with Brahman. That is true, because when you are in deep sleep, when your mind is still, you are in contact with the inner source. And so that's why the sleep replenishes you. That's why the sleep is very necessary to replenish your body, your mind, your intellect, all that.
If you are in irreversible coma, what happens to you?
Then you are in ignorance.
So,
I mean,
so
you are in that.
There's no hope for you? Is that what you're saying?
No. I mean, for this particular life, yeah. I mean, whatever you have done, whatever, see, what is irreversible coma? That the person has, whatever karmas are done, the person is now suffering the consequences of that. So suppose somebody is in coma for 6 months or a year or 2 years, it's actually not a very pleasant existence. So they must have done some karmas for them to suffer that state, when they are on a respirator and being poked and all that. So yeah, that is the terminal stage. And then but they don't accumulate new karmas in that stage. They do not accumulate, but they undergo the results of past karmas. You know, if they're in coma, say, for a year or 2 years, and then they just, suppose they leave the body, then they start a new life with a new body. Or if they wake up from that coma, then again they can start their karma. So, but at deep coma, you cannot realize that God. You cannot. To realize, you have to be awake. You have to be fully awake, and your mind has to be still. So in that state of samadhi, where you are one with that sama-adhi, that is the state of realization. That's why in Ashtanga yoga, you know, those who do yoga, there are 8 steps. Yama, niyama, and asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So samadhi is the 8th step. So first two are control of the mind, control of the senses. Then there is asana, you know, doing the physical exercises. Then pranayama, the breathing. Then pratyahar, then withdrawing from the world, and dharana, and deciding that I am going to detach from the world and attach to God. And then dhyana is meditation, and samadhi is the final, where the I disappears and he alone remains. But that cannot happen in coma. It can happen only in a waking state, where I disappear and he alone remains. Do you have anything to add?
Where you can control your
right.
All organs, because coma you don't control. You
don't control anything, right?
But when you're awake, you're controlling.
Right. That's why Kabir Das Ji says, na, that the prem gali ati sankri, ya wo hai ya hari hai ya main hu to hari nahi, hari hai to main nahi. She says the path of love is very narrow. Either God can be there or you can be there. Both of you cannot be at the same time. If I am there, then God is not there. If God is there, then I am not there. What does he mean, I? He means the ego. Ego cannot survive when the Lord appears, then the ego disappears. Then he alone is. And that is called working without ego. You know,
so
work.
As long as you have ego, there is Advaita.
Advaita, right.
But to be Advaita, the ego has to go.
Right, and that happens either in the path of love or in the path of knowledge. In the path of bhakti, in the path of love, you say God alone is everything and he's working through me. God, I don't exist. You are doing everything. You know, that is, that all Mirabai and, you know, Tukaram and all of these saints started with the path of bhakti, but then they became one. In the path of knowledge, you say, I am that consciousness and this body, mind and intellect is functioning because I am there. So then I, that consciousness alone remains, and this ego even in there should disappear. In the final stage of knowledge, the ego disappears in both stages. In the state of Dvaita, it disappears because God alone is working through me. I am the instrument, He is the doer. And in the path of knowledge, I am that consciousness, and this whole universe is functioning because of me. Because of me means not me as Anil or me as Kerry, but me as that consciousness, that Brahman. And that we'll talk a little more when we talk about Tattvamasi. I think we had talked last week, but I'll need to repeat that how I and that consciousness can be one. So we'll talk about that. Any other comments, questions?
I'm getting a knowledge in different direction, living in a different direction because of the worldly expectations or things. Sometimes it's hard, like what you're knowing and what you're living is
right.
A little bit rough.
Now that's a very good question. I myself had this doubt for a long time. I still have it. I'm not clear yet, but because what is real and what is unreal? Like now in this phone, I see, how can you say the phone is unreal? You can't. The table, she's not unreal, he's not. So the way they describe real and unreal is what is permanent is real, what is changing is unreal. See, what was in the past is in the present and will remain in the future is real. I was not there, you know, some years back I was not there. I am here now, in a few more years I'll be gone. This table was not here and it was created, and the table eventually will be destroyed. So what was there, is there and will always be there is real. What was not there in the past happens to be here in the future, in the present, and in the future will not be there. That is unreal. So temporarily this tree is there, but you know, 10 years from now this tree may not be there. This building was not there before 2006. This was an empty piece of land, and then this building was created. Now another 10-20 years from now, maybe we outgrow it and we have to destroy and make a new building. So what will not be there in the future is unreal. So unreal and real does not mean that if I see it, it's also the way. Another description I read about it is that to you now the world looks very real, right? The world looks very real. Somebody slaps you, the slap is very real. Somebody criticizes you, that's very
emotions
real. Emotions are very real and they hurt.
Yes.
Now suppose you're in a dream. Now in a dream, somebody who doesn't like you comes and slaps you. Now is that pain real in the dream or is it unreal? No, it is real. When you are in the dream, when you're in the dream, it is very real. Like the example they give of a tiger, I always talk about. The tiger is chasing you and you're running up the tree and you're in Africa in the dream. And you run up the tree and you are in the tiger. That fear is real, right? When you wake up sometime, don't you wake up with your heart pounding because the dream was so real? And in that, the Africa, the jungle is real, the tiger is real, I am real. And then there might be a saint or Mahatma who is walking and telling you, look, this dream is not real. You are not in Africa, you are sleeping in your bed in Bakersfield. What will you do? You will crucify that Mahatma because he's telling you something that which is not true. In the dream appears very real. It's only when you wake up, then you say, the dream was not real. It was a creation of my mind. So the Mahatmas, who are the realized masters, tell us, this world is not real. When you wake up to that Turiya state, that state of Om, then you will say, yes, the world was not real. So to you and me, because we are in this dream, the world looks very, and you know, the dream is very short. It's only a few minutes, so we can say it's not. But all the Upanishads use the dream example to tell, because those realized masters, when they wake up to that higher state of Om, then this whole world to them looks like a movie. Then it has no reality, just as a movie. When you're in the movie, it looks very real. When the movie ends, then you say, why was I crying? You know, it was all just a story. So similarly, this world that appears very real when you wake up to that higher state, that is called the fourth state, the Turiya state, then you will say that this world. At this moment, you and I cannot say it because we are so caught in the maya of this world. But when you wake up, then you will say, yes, what Shankaracharya ji said was true, or what Gurudev Swami Chinmayananda said was true. That this world is unreal.
Like, if there's a problem, you have to act and react according, not real, but you have to make decisions and you have to act on it. That's kind of...
Yeah, no, no, we are not saying that you don't act in the world, but don't take the world too seriously. Take it as a joke. That this world is a great big joke. There is a jokester up there, comedian, who is doing all these tricks. Enjoy the world and have fun and go and say, it's not, don't give too much importance. Somebody said something, it's temporary, you know. Something, some illness come, is temporary. Even if the body is dropping, it was temporary anyway. So don't give too much importance to temporary things. Hold on to the permanent. If you want permanent joy, hold on to the permanent. If you want permanent peace, hold on to the permanent. If you want temporary joy, temporary peace, yeah, you will get it from a slice of pizza or an ice cream or a piece of jewelry. But if you want permanent peace, look for the permanent. And do not give too much importance to this world. World is not important. He is the only thing that is important. In fact, that's what I'm going to tell the children today. What is the goal in life? And the goal in life is to know him, to realize, to, that is the only reason I was born. I was not born to accumulate money. I was not born to build a house, have a family, have children, have a profession. I may be the most successful. I may be Bill Gates, or I may be, you know, the king of England, or I may be whatever. Your life, unless you have realized the truth, your life is a waste. You have not fulfilled the purpose of life. A human life is given to realize, realize and realize. There is no other reason to be born. Otherwise, you have wasted your life. In fact, my mother used to say, actually, I keep quoting her, she used to say, Janani jane to bhakt jane, ya data ya sur, nahi to janani banj bhali, kahe gawai noor. He said a mother should either give birth to a bhakta, a devotee, or a data, a charitable person, or a shur, or a brave warrior. Otherwise, she has wasted her life. Otherwise, she has wasted her youth, you know, in producing children who are just useless children. Either they should be either devotees of Lord or charitable, honored, good people, or brave people who do sacrifice for the country. Otherwise, so that's what I'm saying is, so my life also should be one of these three. Otherwise, I wasted my life. So I'm only here to realize that is the only purpose of my existence. That is the only reason I was born. Once you have that goal in mind, then everything else falls in place. Then everything else I do, yes, whatever, but that is not my main goal in life. So I do activities that will take me in that direction and avoid activities that will take me away. I mean, we all should do that. You know, all the time we can't, but as much as possible, one should do that. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramaya, Sarve Bhadrani Pasyantu, Makasche Dukkha Bhagavet. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Guru Bhyo, Hari Om.